Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
You're back in the House of Mystery, and here we go again. We are True Crime All the Time. We want to thank some of the new stations for joining us. We've got WXEI in Pensacola now, running us at 1 Monday to Friday. And, of course, Utah's got two stations now, KYAH, 540 AM, and KFEX, and that is 95.3 FM. And they run us 4 o'clock Mountain Time. So joining us, we have a special guest right from Seattle here, and she's one of our own, lawyer, Ann Bremner. Thank you for being here.
It's an honor to be. Thanks for having me.
Oh, welcome.
So, thank you.
You've done so many cases, and, you know, one I was thinking about was the Amanda Knox, of course, and I've talked to her, and, mm-hmm. and it was quite a story. But one thing that, as a lawyer, you know, how is it dealing with the law systems in other countries? So, like, when you have to deal, when she's in Italy and arrested for murder, is it a real rush for you? Like, do you have to learn a lot about how they run their system and sort of kind of communicate that?
Well, absolutely. It was very difficult in her case. I mean, the Italian system is quite different from ours here in the United States. Now, for example, here in the U.S., you can be held only 72 hours on a crime before being charged. Otherwise, they have to let you go. In Italy, it's 2 years.
Oh,
that
wow.
was one thing, and those are closed hearings. And the other thing in terms of the differences was that they didn't meet, you know, consistently day after day in a trial. They would meet on weekends and then take summers off and things like that. So it was like we used to say one huge Italian opera. This case went on and on and on. It was very dramatic. So those are just a few things. And, of course, they don't sequester jurors, so jurors are reading media, you know, et cetera, and they don't really have the burden of proof that we have here. And that's just a start in terms of differences, quite a different system.
How do you feel they treated you? Like, when you're, you know, dealing with the prosecution sort of side or the Crown side, do you find that they have a different way of dealing with you or treating you as a defense attorney?
Well, I think the prosecutor in this case, you know, I mean, he was actually prosecuted for abuse of office during the course of Amanda's and Raffaelli's prosecutions and convicted. So he didn't look at us, you know, he kind of looked at us out in Seattle, that those of us that supported and worked with Amanda, they looked at us, I think, as scams. But the system itself, I think, you know, it's Roman. It's based on Roman law. It's an older system than ours. It's based on English common law. And I think, you know, it's a system that works for them and it should be accorded respect. Overall, I think we were treated relatively well. But keeping in mind, she had her own lawyers in Italy that were actually, you know, in combat every day or when they were in session during the trial against the prosecutor.
Yeah.
Now, I have to ask, do you think that the Italian lawyers were doing as good a job as the American lawyers since she was an American citizen? Was there any, bias?
It's really hard to tell when sitting out here in Seattle and dealing with that case over the last decade. It appeared that they did a good job. Raffaele's lawyer was considered the top lawyer. Her name was Bongiorno in Italy. And she's still his lawyer because he's looking to get compensated for the wrongful prosecution. And, it was a tough case. The judge wouldn't allow independent evidence in the first trial. It was allowed in the second trial, and that's what ended up in the exoneration, of Amanda and Raffaele.
Okay.
Do you think that'll ever is it over now? Because you know how they kind of overturn it.
Yeah.
I mean, it just keeps going back and forth. And I'm saying, will it ever really end, or is it done, or is it going to keep going, or what?
That's a great question. This wasn't just double jeopardy in this case; it was triple jeopardy. There was a conviction, and then that was overturned in a de novo appeal, which means you tried the case all over again on appeal. So the conviction is overturned, and then remember, Amanda came home once it was overturned, and yet the Italian courts reinstated the case and tried her again in absentia and convicted her. So that's a three trials. We have a prohibition against double jeopardy in this country, but they just kept going in Italy. So that's a great question you ask, and they keep going. But apparently, it finally went to the Supreme Court in Italy, and the Supreme Court said not only are these two innocent, they are exonerated. They are completely stone cold innocent. There was no evidence against them. There was no reason to hold them, and it's done. But that took 10 years.
Yeah.
That's a total of 10 years.
Yeah. I could not imagine how much of a toll that's really taken on her life and how it's,
absolutely.
And how it can change your life when you go through that. Like that's 10 years you'll never get back. And
right. It's
a whole new road now. And I just could not imagine what it would feel like to be in that kind of a spotlight that long like that. And so many people were, there's a lot of people that still really badmouth her and talk negative.
That's right.
I just roll my eyes. It's like, come on, because they really didn't. They knew who the killer was.
They not only knew who the killer was, Rudy, today, he was convicted in a fast-track trial during that preliminary hearing. Those things were tried together. He was convicted. His DNA, was all over the house. You've got his, fingerprints on Mary's purse. There's bloody handprints down the walls. There's DNA in the toilet that was his. There were footprints, at least one that was his. And he confessed on Skype, and he fled the jurisdiction. Evidence of flight is evidence of guilt. He fled. So he was the one. He was convicted. And that was done before Amanda and Raff's first trial.
Yeah. I shouldn't
before
laugh.
Before their trial.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah. I still find that astonishing, though. How can he, how can he do an interview over Skype? I mean, that to me is just astonishing. I'm speechless, and I remember when it happened. But how can you interview over Skype?
Oh, I know. And he did. And he, in terms of the evidence he left behind at the scene, it was overwhelming in terms of, indicating his guilt. He knew it because a fast track trial is really, from Italy, is really a slow track guilty plea. It's a slow guilty plea, like you see in the U.S. It just takes a little longer.
Yeah.
And it gets you a better deal. He got a better sentence than he would have gotten if he went to trial. That's why he did it.
Now, could that happen here in the U.S.? Like, could you?
No.
You couldn't do that sort of thing in the U.S. It just wouldn't happen.
It wouldn't happen because we don't try things together like that. They tried the three of them together in the preliminary hearing. And remember, in the trial, they tried the civil cases with the criminal cases. So Patrick Lumumba's defamation case, the bar owner, the civil case of the family for wrongful death, those were all tried together. We don't do that here. And we don't have a slow guilty plea. We have what's called a pretty quick guilty plea. I mean, if you're going to plead guilty, then you're going to do it at the time. And in this country, you know, the only things that are certain are death, taxes, and you can't withdraw a guilty plea. I mean, a guilty plea is solid and forever. So that's, if that happened here, he would have pled guilty without any evidence being put forward other than what he admits to in a guilty plea, and it would be over. It wouldn't have been a two-year-long process before he was found guilty.
Wow. You know, what's your opinion now on the legal system? And that's a huge question, but what I mean is, what I mean sort of is, we had Marcia Clark on and we talked about that. The legal system as it is for a woman in it as compared to a man, because there's so much talk about this stuff right now with the Eagle Rights and Me Too and all that stuff, which is great. But how do you feel in the position that you're in? Do you feel treated differently as a woman?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Why?
I mean, I don't know what Marcia said.
She went crazy on it. She went from.
I met Marcia.
Lovely
That's
person.
That's how to stand
out. Lovely person. She
Isn't
went crazy.
She's wonderful.
Yeah, she went crazy. It was just. So you feel like you kind of get a little bit less of this. I don't know how to put this. Do you feel like there's a little bit less power as a woman in your position, or equal, or kind of where do you find the problems? If I don't even know if that's the right word, but.
I think there's a lot of problems in being female in the system, whether you're accused or, you know, you're a litigant or whether you're a lawyer. But what I've encountered over the years, and I've been a trial lawyer for 35 years, I used to be a DA, is that when I was younger, things like this would happen. I was a prosecutor. The judge would say, "Ms. Bremner, can you babysit the defendant's kids in the hallway?" You know,
what?
And I would say yes.
Well, it's
and not... I did say later I wouldn't leave anyone's kids with me. But anyway, I'm just joking. But yeah. You know, those kinds of things, you know, it happened in my career, and sometimes, you know, you get the honeys, the sweeties, that kind of thing. But more it's I'm not a big complainer about things like this. I'm just telling you some things I've seen. Is that there can be, you can be demeaned sometimes by opposing counsel or sometimes by a judge, or people think, well, she wouldn't have a big client like that. You know, that would be a guy, you know, some of those kinds of more subtle assumptions. And I've seen it from, you know, lawyers that have worked for me, you know, like, is that your client? I'm like, well, yeah, actually it is. You know, they chose me. Right. But so it can be kind of subtle, but in all the years I've practiced, I have to say that it's a real strength for me to be a female lawyer. I'd rather be nothing else. I think women have more range with juries. I think we're more empathetic in a lot of ways. I think that we get a little more latitude in the way that we present our cases, a little more creativity. And I think that, you know, our relationships with our clients can be very, very close. And so, on balance, it's been a wonderful thing for me. But, you know, there's definitely, I can say, me too, in terms of some problem.
See,
for sure.
Me
for sure.
Too. Time's up.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Time's
well,
up. Me too.
Well, I can't. We're going to have Nancy Grace next month because she's promoting the new show.
You are.
Yeah. Her and Dan Abrams are doing the new A&E show where they retry 12 cases or something, and they're retrying them. So they're doing a promo bit. So those two are going to be on, and I'll find out from her if she took anything from any men.
Nancy?
Yeah.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
I love Nancy. But, you know, I'm sure she's encountered it, but whether or not she, you know, didn't fight it, I mean,
I could,
she's
I wouldn't
tough.
Have the guts. I would not have the guts to say anything. She's really nice that I've talked to her, and she's really sweet.
She's wonderful.
Not as aggressive as she was on the show, but you must have had a good time
on
that show. You must have had a great time on that show.
I had a great time on that show, and I'll tell you, whenever if Nancy was tough on me, I just smiled. You know, like, I'm not going to fight with Nancy Grace.
Yeah.
But you're right. She's sweet. She's a good friend. She's loyal. She's so kind, and she's wonderful to everyone in her life. And I've known her now for 20 years, and I just think the world of her. I consider her a very, very good friend, a very dear friend.
Yeah, very, very nice lady. Now the James Chassee murder, that was a big case for you as well, wasn't it?
In Portland, yes. Yeah. That was a civil case, the police case.
Do you think that, because that involves kind of police killing someone that, you know, it was deemed he shouldn't have. Do you think that goes on more now, or is that getting more of a problem or less of a problem? You know, the whole concept of police abuse and racism against police and blacks, you know, this whole thing. What's your opinion on the direction it's going in?
I think it's getting a lot more publicity, a lot more attention, and that's obvious, you know, across the nation. And we see, you know, big cases everywhere from New York to South Carolina to Seattle, you know, to Chicago to Baltimore, you know, et cetera, and the big cases. I have handled police shootings and death cases for Seattle police for decades, and also, of course, in Portland, in King County and other jurisdictions. And from my perspective, there have been claimed to be controversial police-involved deaths throughout my career. And so when I've seen the more recent publicity, you know, I know from the cases that I've handled that this is we've had these kinds of cases for a long time. No police officer wants to kill anybody. You know, I've usually been on the scene right after it happens. And, you know, the use of force by a police officer is extremely serious. And very serious to the officer themselves. So, and with Seattle juries, I've never had an inquest jury find against an officer over the years. So, but to answer your question, is it something that's new, different? At least from my perspective, you know, we've had kind of a consistent number of deaths, you know, per year, very unfortunately, at least in Seattle. And I think there's just a lot more attention to these types of cases. Are the police getting worse in other cities? I just don't know. I don't have a basis to know, but I have a lot of confidence in the Seattle police and the Portland police.
Yeah. You know, no, they're quite good. I had the chief of police on, and we really enjoy the police, but I was just wondering, because mm-hmm. there's so much attention brought to it now, if you think it's going to go anywhere. It doesn't seem to change, I think, is my opinion.
Well,
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I kind of want to disagree with that, because we are changing policies. I work in law enforcement, and we are revisiting a lot of our policies simply due to the attention. You know, it's bringing more focus. Like, hey, maybe it's time that we revisit some of these policies.
Exactly. No, you're exactly right. And I think that's very, very important. It's been embraced here in Seattle, I know, in Portland. What I've advocated for all along is transparency, and that we should have an inquest system where a jury hears the facts, not just shooting review board by department, but an actual proceeding, not a grand jury secret proceeding, but a proceeding that's open to the public, examining who, what, where, when, how. Each side has counsel, the decedent's family, the police themselves, there's a prosecutor, a judge. The more transparency we can have in the recounting of these unfortunate incidents, the better, so that we can understand and, like you said, examine and maybe change policies and take a look at things we can do better in the future. We can always do better. But to make sure everybody understands exactly what happened in any kind of officer-involved shooting or use of deadly force.
Now, here's an idea that I thought about, you know, some years ago, is getting the public involved in those type of panels. You know,
right.
Give them a little bit of education and then say, what do you think of this? Now, but
right.
it's difficult now because there seems to be such a anti-law enforcement bias lately. What is your opinion on that? I mean, it's almost like we've kind of painted ourselves into a corner.
I know. And the thing is, you know, in terms of some of the shootings, it just becomes polarized in an instant. So that nobody's willing to, you know, it's kind of like it's all over except for the shouting. We don't see a discourse about, you know, some of the shootings and they're decided in public opinion immediately. And so I think it's really, really difficult. We have to keep moving to where that there's excellent policies, you know, the use of deadly force is appropriate, and it's used as last resort, and that we don't have any of these kind of controversial shootings. And they're sure out there. I acknowledge that, you know, around the nation. They're out there. Mm-hmm. But they're so polarizing that I don't know that we, you know, can get the conversations where they need to be. I think it's good for the public to be involved in an inquest, and they are, as inquest jurors in Seattle. They just stopped inquests in this state, or in this county, by the way. The county executive put a moratorium on it to reexamine that process. But I still think it's the best process out there, as opposed to having a secret grand jury, you know, having something, you know, where it's just internal review on a shooting alone, or just a decision, you know, by a prosecutor about what to do with the officer, criminal versus non, without any kind of evidence review that's formal. You know, that you just have someone make a decision based upon the police interviews or police reports and not have an actual evidentiary hearing with witnesses and evidence.
Now, perhaps a lot of that will change, though, because now a lot of departments are going to all body cam all the time.
Right. I think it's great.
Yeah, I was going to say...
Downside to that.
No. I was going to say, too, that one thing I learned just in an interview a little while back is about the Rafe Burns case, you know, in Bellevue, the two kids from Vancouver.
Oh, sure.
You know, because we were dealing with...
Horrible case.
Yeah, and we're dealing with the Mr. Big thing out of Canada and Project Innocence. I didn't realize this, and I feel really stupid. Now...
Never.
Well, no, I do, because when they do not offer parole in the state of Washington.
Oh, no, they don't, huh?
So,
what?
See, I knew Kevin wouldn't know this either. If you're in Washington, like these two kids got convicted for the murder. You weren't on that interview. But, and now there's, you know, there's a lot of controversy whether they did it or not, blah, blah, blah. We don't need to get into that, but... I just found out when we were doing that interview, because the Project Innocent, Ken Klonsky, the guy trying to help them get out, says there's no parole in Washington. So you get 20 years, you get 20 years.
Exactly. We have what's called sentencing reform. It's the SRA, Sentencing Reform Act, and it was enacted in the early 80s. And it's basically saying that they felt that parole was abused, and they felt the commission, the sentencing, or the commission, and also the legislature. And so it was basically, you do the crime, you do the time. There's set ranges, looking at the crime itself, looking at your criminal history, you know, looking at other factors, and you're going to serve that time within a range. And then when you're out, you get what's called community supervision for short term, but parole is gone. There was like an anecdotal story that a judge once had sentenced somebody to like sit in his lawyer's office for a couple of hours on a serious case. I mean, that's the kind of things people were saying. It's like, and then parole would be granted too early, you know, for people, and they would go out and commit heinous crimes. So in our state, we said it's all sentencing reform, and we have specific times that you do, depending on the crime and your history, and then when you're done, you're done.
Do you like it? Do you think it's working?
I like it because I think it does give certainty. And I think when I was a prosecutor, I thought a lot of the ranges were too small, especially for like negligent homicide, like with the DUI. You know, some of those were seemed to me to be, you know, lighter sentences. Again, like negligent homicide is not a lot of time. So some crimes you think, geez, it should be a lot more time than that. But for anybody's sentence, they probably think it's way too much time. And I remember the Burns and the Fake Eight.
Yeah.
Remember, they went to Canada. They went up to Canada.
Yeah.
And had to be extradited.
Right. And, of course, Canada wouldn't extradite them because it was a death penalty case.
Exactly. And so that's why they came back and they were tried, you know, only looking at a license.
How do you, actually, you're a lawyer. This is good. What do you think about, no, because what do you think about that Mr. Big thing? Because... In Canada, Kevin, they do a Mr. Big sting. So the kids are up in Canada, and the RCMP undercover force pretends to be gangsters or kind of bad people, and they befriend the people that they feel have committed a crime. And so then what they do is they get them to do, you know, run guns, drugs, steal cars, do all these fake crimes that they've made. And once they get the trust, then they end up getting the information about, oh, so tell me about those, that woman you killed, you know, or something. They'll get into that and they record it. And that's a recorded confession. Now in the States, that's entrapment, isn't it? In Canada, it's still considered legal. But they used what the Canadian policing did to convict those two in the States. How can that be? Because if that was American cops that did this same thing to them in Bellevue, it wouldn't be allowed. So why is it allowed to take something that you couldn't do in this country from another country? Like, that's confusing to me.
Well, I mean, it was legal in the country where it occurred. And I actually went to that trial. I remember watching or listening to some of those tapes of Burns and Raffaele talking to the quote-unquote bad guy mobster people.
Yeah.
But entrapment's pretty hard to prove. You have to basically show that you wouldn't have had that thought in your mind unless the authorities, you know, got it implanted into you or, you know, persuaded you to do this, but you didn't, you basically in a lot of ways, you know, wouldn't have done the crime otherwise. And I think the Canadian case, they spent quite a bit of time hanging out with these two and getting them to talk. And then the tapes were deemed to be admissible by a judge. I presume an argument was made, like you said, to Judge Martel, who was the trial judge, you know, something like, you know, well, this is not, wouldn't be legal here, so it shouldn't be admissible. I'm sure that was tested.
Yeah.
To the judge, but he let him in.
Yeah, because it's a voluntary utterance.
Yeah, definitely. They were bragging, as I remember, they you know, there was quite a bit, I think, of tape in that case.
Oh, there was. They did 5 months. And the Sebastian Burns is the one that did the bragging. But he was, you know, when you looked at him throughout the whole 5 months, even when they didn't talk about the case, he was very arrogant. He was...
Yes.
He came across that way. Like, he would tell the judge what was wrong, you know, in the case. He was very flippant to people. So people didn't like him.
Right.
Raffaele was really quiet mm-hmm. and polite and mannered and didn't really go off.
And so wasn't Raffaele's sister the one that was murdered besides the parents?
Yeah. She was the one with autism and 20 years old.
It's horrible, yeah.
Oh, it was a terrible beating. Terrible. Awful. That was brutal.
Terrible.
And especially in Bellevue, something that just you'd never heard of, you know. So many of those, because now the Supreme Court of Canada sort of put a real kibosh on that sort of Mr. Big thing.
So, mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are being overturned.
Well, I think that, you know, the thing with Burns and Raffaele was that, you know, it was such a horrific crime, and then they were gone, you know, to Canada, they absconded. And then, I don't know if you remember this, but Burns said he'd been involved sexually with his own lawyer. So that was whole other side show.
Yeah. She got kicked off the case. Yeah. Man.
Right. So it was really protracted, you know, from the crime until they were actually convicted.
Yeah, this would be a great movie.
Yeah. It's terrible case.
Well, it's a terrible case. And I know that they're, Sebastian Burns is done with his appeals, but I know Raffaele's still on his. So we'll see where.
Well, and you know, they just finished doing a number of pieces on the Menendez brothers 25 years later. I think Netflix did one and they did a Law and Order to Wolf series on that case.
Yeah. Yeah. We actually just talked to them on the A&E one where they had that. And, you know, some of these cases, which sticks with you for the longest? Like right now, that you were involved with, or even if you weren't, what stays with you?
I think the Susan Cox Powell case, because she's never been found, and then when her husband, the suspect, came out to Washington, the kids were given to him through DSHS, and he blew them up in the house, killed them with a hatchet. And Susan still hasn't been found. And it was just such a horrible tragedy to, like, a wonderful family, you know, who I've worked with for years. It's just like there's, I've never seen, in all of the cases I've covered or handled myself, such like a horrible set of circumstances. You know, those little boys, you know.
Yeah.
They were running to their dad. He said, I was surprised. And he set the house on fire and killed them with hatchet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was terrible.
Terrible.
What do you like better, defense or prosecution? What did you like personally doing better? Or I guess you have to say defense now, but
I like all of it. I like all of it. I'm like, you know, there's that saying that only lawyers and painters can turn black to white. You know, it's like you come into the situation. I guess I'm more just based on the client or the case as opposed to what side of it I'm on. I think it's most rewarding to be a prosecutor and represent victims, but I represent victims in civil cases too. And so I find that to be the most gratifying, that people that don't have access to justice in a lot of ways, I like to help with that. Amanda Knox was very gratifying. You know, there's somebody that everyone thought was guilty in the beginning. And, all types of horrors were raining on her head. And to have gotten involved in that, you know, and trying to help somebody, you know, that almost seemed beyond help in the beginning, it's really gratifying to me. It's a great thing to be a lawyer that you can use those skills in our system to help people. And so I know it sounds kind of simple and almost cheesy, but there's nothing like it, I think. When she came home, I mean, I was crying like a baby. I mean, it was just like when I heard the news.
Yeah.
You know, when certain cases, when justice prevails, I mean, there's just nothing like it.
Did you think that we have some sort of, like with the wrongful convictions that have been coming out lately and a lot of the talk about that, do you think that we need to reassess some of the trials, some of the conviction sort of things? Like should we be showing them on TV? You were talking about public and they all get on one side or the other because of whatever they see, but without really seeing the evidence. So should we really be televising everything as it goes and exposing everybody to it, or should we kind of keep it a little bit more quiet?
Well, I think we should televise things, and that's part of, you know, access to justice and our rights as citizens. But it's also the right of the accused under the Constitution to have the public, you know, examine their trial for fairness. I mean, it's not just public access rights. It's the right of the accused to have their proceedings scrutinized, you know, for fairness. And, you know, I cover some trials for some of the cable networks. And Scott Peterson's case, remember, was fully televised.
Right.
Michael Jackson's wasn't. Casey Anthony was. You know, it's like O.J. Simpson, of course, we know the trial of the century.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's helpful for the public to see exactly what the evidence is if the public wants to see it in a high-profile trial. And in Michael Jackson's case, you know, we would have to come out as lawyers and address the media about some of the legal issues. And I was put in a position saying what happened in court. Why not just have people, the public, see what's happening in court? You know, the Court TV was a great network. You know, Dan and Nancy both do a lot with public trials. You know, Dan's got his own network now, the Law News Network,
right,
covering live trials. And I think people want to see live trials. And I think that's the best way to see justice at work, our system at work. And people can make their own conclusions watching the evidence. Of course, the jury's going to decide and the judge is going to decide.
I think, well, no, I just, the only thing is, because like we were in Phoenix, we still are, our show, but that's where it was originated. And the Jody Arias trial was on, so of course we had, Kirk Nurmi, and we've had, Martinez. You know, we did the whole thing several times.
Mm-hmm.
How can you see? Because I look at Kirk Nurmi and it wrecked his life.
I know.
And I just don't. How can you do your job when you're under that much scrutiny? Like, oh, did he get a operation? Did he lose weight? What color tie is that he's wearing? Or he's, you know, all these name callings, and then the threats on their families, and then the, we're gonna kill your daughter, and you know all the stuff they were getting. I'm thinking, if I was in, I mean, I don't know, I'm not a lawyer, but if I was a lawyer under that kind of scrutiny, I think it would be very hard to do my job, not because I'm inadequate, but because, wow, that's pressure I'm not used to being on. All of a sudden, I'm on every cable channel 24/7, and everybody's got an opinion about me.
Yeah, I mean, for someone like that, I feel horrible for him, you know, what he went through, and especially with someone like Jody Arias as a client. I mean, she was demonized in the public. There's no, as you know, no doubt. And of course, Marcia knows what that is. You know, she was prosecuting O.J. Simpson, and, you know, any number of these cases, you do have that. That's a real big downside. Even in the Amanda Knox case, I had people make death threats, put me in felons' outfits, doctor pictures, put them on the web, you know, all kind of put my address out there. There's a whole world now with social media and the media where it can be really menacing.
Well, doesn't that, like, but what I'm saying is, but doesn't that, okay, so you're here with getting little bad comments about Amanda and threats. Doesn't that take the attention away from what you're doing, or doesn't that kind of affect you? Like, I'm just trying to get into the mind of how that would affect you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not on the level of Marcia or anybody else that has big cases in the media, so I can't really speak to that kind of exposure. But no matter what the exposure is and the negativity, sure, it affects you. I mean, I've had police protection at my house. You know, I've had an alarm installed in my house that goes directly to the police department, and it can definitely affect you. I mean, it would affect anybody, whether you're getting threats, whether you're getting smears, you know, whether you're getting, you know, criticism that's not fair. That's a huge scale to be in, to be that prominent in an international case or national case, especially when you represent, you know, the damned. I mean, that's what she was, Casey, or Joni Arias. You're the attorney for the damned, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's revisit media coverage of high-profile crimes. I think one of the points that Al was alluding to is, do you think that major coverage of a crime before the trial, do you think that could prejudice any potential jury pool? And how do you get around that as a defense attorney?
That's a great point. And that's the analysis. When there's prejudicial information out there that could taint the jury pool, then there's a real concern. Prosecutors under the ethical rules are not allowed to say much, and they shouldn't. I mean, they should simply say, this is a crime, this person's been arrested, this is a trial date, and not talk about statements of the accused, potentially inadmissible evidence, you know, characterize the accused, any of those things. And that helps a lot when a prosecutor basically stands by what they're duty-bound to not do or say. And then when you deal with, if it's out everywhere in the media, then you have to deal with the question of the change of venue. I mean, but it can only be within your own state. And with the internet, yes, it doesn't really seem, you know, it's not really make a difference whether you try a case in Seattle or with the island or anything else, because it's everywhere. So it's really tough. And I was going to mention the first case I remember like this historically was the Fatty Arbuckle case in San Francisco that really made Hearst, you know, rich and able to build, I would say he was able to build San Simeon, because Fatty Arbuckle was the most popular Hollywood comedian of the day. He was accused of a homicide, a rape and a homicide, and it was all over all the time in the newspaper, the Hearst newspapers. And he was tried three times, and he didn't do it. And the jury said he didn't do it, and he died, like, at the age of 50 after three trials. There was so much salacious coverage about him. It was a party to San Francisco. I think it was the Mark Hopkins or the St. Francis, and a woman, you know, died from sepsis, but they said he had sex with her and he's so fat he killed her, and on and on and on. It sold newspapers like crazy.
But there's really no way to avoid that. Like you said, in today's, you know, digital age, you know, we've got CNN, we've got Fox, we have major networks. For example, a local example, we had the Amy Bishop killing here, where, you know, she shot her colleagues over here at UAH. Oh, my God, that was on Fox News, CNN, before, you know, before the investigators knew what was going on. And now I have to question if somebody like that has a fair trial, like you said, even with a change of venue. Doesn't something like that start actually with the investigators releasing information? And
yeah,
there's really no way to stop that, is there?
No, except for that the investigators shouldn't be releasing anything the prosecutor couldn't release. And so they need to be really careful about not sending things out into the media. Because you're going to say, as a defense attorney, they've impacted my client's right to a fair trial negatively by releasing a bunch of things. Maybe it's not evidence that will come in. You know, that's a lot of the problem. The jury gets tainted beforehand.
Yeah. Now, part two of this, and this is the conundrum. Let's look at the Las Vegas shooters. This is a situation where they're trying to withhold information so that they don't, you know, create an opinion and effectively try this man in the media who is already deceased. But now you've got the media and the public putting pressure on the sheriff's department. We want information. We want information that they don't have. So, you know, there's a strange balance that has to be reached between appeasing the public but assuring this person's rights.
Yeah, beautifully stated. And when you look at the requirements ethically of a prosecutor, part of that is if it's necessary for public safety, there's certain things you should say and certain things you can say. You know, as a person at large, you know, are people at risk? Those are the kinds of things they should say.
Yeah. Well, there we have it. Sometimes I just think that the position of people when they get in that kind of spotlight is it's got to be real difficult, you know. But
well, yeah, and when you look at hundreds of people being shot and scores of people dying, the enormity of that has just got to be overwhelming for anybody.
Yeah,
it was for all of us.
Yeah, it was quite the tragedy, unfortunately, it probably keep on happening. But think positive. Stop it, Kevin.
Exactly. Think positive, right?
Yeah. Well, so Anne, what's kind of going on now? You've got a lot of cases going and stuff, and anything in the works for you for 2018?
No, I've got a lot of cases. We still have the Susan Cox Powell case against the Child Protective Services where they didn't protect those boys. They gave the boys to Stephen Powell, so that's pending in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I've done some documentaries recently on everything from Scott Peterson to Rebecca Zahow to the Menendez brothers. And the Rebecca Zahow trial is starting soon in California. Remember, she was the one hanging naked off the balcony in Coronado? And they called it a suicide. And she was bound and gagged. I know, I said, I've never seen a suicide like that. I represented the family in the criminal investigation. So I'll be interested to see what happens with that. Hope they get justice. And I'm trying to do a little bit more, like, insight on Amanda Knox's case, you know, and to figure out lessons learned and what it means, you know, to the wrongfully accused and convicted. You know, what kind of lessons have been learned from that case? Because it was, you know, the biggest case of its kind of a wrongful prosecution internationally.
Okay. Kevin, I thought you had one more.
Oh, yeah. I've got to ask this. Just out of curiosity, you know, this is for my own selfish indulgence here. Is there a case that you've ever regretted taking as a defense?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah.
You know what? There's more than one. I can tell you that, but I can't tell you which cases.
Yeah. Not on air. Come on, you can't.
Yeah, I don't know if they're listening.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, you never know. Okay, you can always say, "Hey, if you're listening right now, turn us off."
Yeah, but
yeah, everybody listens to you guys.
Yeah.
So, no, I mean, I'll just say, I have some regrets. I'll leave it at that.
Now, Al, you can tell she's a good attorney because she answered the question without answering it.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank that's you. Right. Thanks for the compliment.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how it goes. Well, Anne,
it is, yeah.
we're going to wrap it up, but thank you very much. This has been a pleasure. And you know, anytime you have anything to talk about or if you want to have any news about anything or cases and you want to bring out some information, we are more than happy because we do crime all the time. We're 5 days a week, and we're open to it because you're in Seattle. That's our home station here, so we're always promoting stuff like that.
Well, it's been such an honor and a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. The honor was ours.
Okay, we're back, and joining us now is Joe Yusinski, and he's going to be talking about Countdown of Conspiracies. Say, Joe, how you doing?
Very good. Happy New Year to you and yours, and Happy New Year to all of our listeners. It's great to be back, and if 2017 was the year of conspiracy, I think 2018 will probably surpass it. So I've got our three for our first week of 2018, but before I wanted to do that, I wanted to share with you guys the result of a new poll that was taken in France in December, and the results just came out yesterday. So people like to think, oh, the United States is a bunch of conspiracy kooks. Well, what about those French? What do the French think about conspiracy theories? So how about I name the conspiracy theory? We'll make this fun. I'll name the conspiracy theory, and you guys tell me what percentage of French people believe in it, and we'll see if you can get it right.
Oh, wow.
Surprise. Okay.
Okay, so how many believe that JFK was killed by a conspiracy? Now, again, these aren't Americans. How many French people believe in the JFK assassination conspiracy?
Ooh. Oh, ooh. Boy.
I'll say... Go ahead, Al.
Oh, 30%.
I'm going to go 70.
Ooh.
Okay, we've got 30 and 70. The correct answer is we're going to split the difference. It's 54%.
Whoa.
So a majority of French people, and that's not actually far off from the American number, which holds at about 60 right now.
Oh.
Okay, so that's the mundane. Now let's get weird for a minute. So... this isn't a big theory in our country explicitly, but it's a big one in Europe. It's called the replacement conspiracy theory. And that theory says that the governments are trying to get rid of white European people and replace them all with low-cost immigrant non-white workers. So what percentage of French people do you think believe in that conspiracy theory?
Oh, boy, right now, since they're living it, oh, I'm going to stick with my original guess. I'm going to drop it to 40.
So 40?
No, it's closer to 60, 65. Yeah, 60.
Okay, 40 and 60. Okay, again, we're going to split the difference. 48% of French people believe in the replacement theory.
See, and that's a lot. I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah. If you were to put that in the U.S., you'd probably have, you know, a much smaller number than that, maybe 15, 20%. But over there, where it's pretty salient.
Depends where you are. In Alabama, it's probably around 90.
Yeah, about 98.
Yeah. No, but that didn't surprise me because Le Pen won 30%, 35% of the vote. And I think 50, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's why I figured 60, you know.
Huh. Okay, so here's one. How many French people do you think believe in flat Earth?
Oh, wow. 10%.
Okay, is that the answer for both?
That's for
no.
Me.
That's Al's guess. Flat earthers. Okay. I mean, it's making a comeback. 25.
Okay, 10 and 25. Al's correct. Yeah. 10%.
Oh,
right on the head.
Oh, I win the prize. Woohoo! I don't know what it was.
So I'll give you the rundown of the rest of these. About 32% believe that AIDS is a conspiracy theory. 31% think that Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations were created by Western security agencies like the CIA. 16% buy into the moon landings, and that's actually higher than it is here in the U.S. In the U.S., it's about 6. And a majority of French people, 55%, think that pharmaceutical companies and the government are hiding the true dangers of vaccines. So that's actually probably double what it is in the U.S.
Wow. I wonder why they're on so much. So they seem to be more an edge than America. I'm surprised by that a little bit.
You know, given recent events, it doesn't actually shock me. The 10% for the flat earth thing does. That's a little bit disturbing. but I've seen polls in this country where you get 6% for the lizard people. So.
Yeah, well, you mean it's not true?
Well, for 94%, it's not. For the other 6, they're living in, you know, V.
Oh.
Hey, that was based on a true story.
Yeah, that's it. In Alabama, again. It has to be.
They keep killing my cattle.
Oh, you're going to have to go to the pharmacy soon for that. Yeah. Okay, so now, what's the big conspiracy going on right now, or is there?
Okay, so we've got our top three, and number three for this week takes place in my home state of Florida. And this is based on a video that's currently posted on YouTube, and you can find it. And it has a Google satellite image of an aerospace company that's located out in the Florida swamp. And supposedly it has an alien diamond-shaped stealth spacecraft. And they think that this is actually an alien craft that may have been captured. And they're keeping it here in a Florida swamp. So, but it's you can actually find the video on YouTube, and it shows you a nice overhead view of the spacecraft. Now, I don't know if it's a spacecraft or not, and because it's sitting on the ground, you know, you can't even actually tell if it can fly or if it's just a fancy car. But if we make these assumptions, it does look like, you know, it would, if we saw it in the sky, we would probably classify it as an unidentified flying object. So,
well, but why would they be keeping it in a swamp?
Well, from what I can tell is that this is an aerospace company that they have out there. So they build this technology out there on cheap land, and probably to stay away from prying eyes. So I guess if you're going to keep a, you know, an alien spacecraft somewhere, you won't do it out in the city. You would do it out, you know, obviously in, you know, the sticks.
Wow. Well, I mean, if I was going to hide a spaceship, I'd leave it in Alabama.
I would just put it in my garage.
Yeah. In a barn.
In a barn.
Yeah, in the drive-thru.
So that's our number three. And Florida has a lot of this weird stuff going on. So, you know, we were the first state with a zombie attack that happened a couple of years ago. So having an alien spacecraft isn't out of the ordinary for us. So number two has to do with Apple and our iPhones. And there are two things going on here. And if you're Apple users, you've probably already heard about this. But there's been a conspiracy theory for a long time that Apple has been throttling the phones. So if you have an older model iPhone, that they've been purposely making it slower so that you have to go buy the new model. And there's a adjacent conspiracy theory that says that they're making the older phones obsolete so that they just break and then you have to go buy the new phone. Now, Apple has said that, no, this isn't true, and there's actually quite a few court cases about this. But they're saying that, yes, they do slow the phones down, but it's only, you know, for security reasons and to make sure that the phones run well and don't crash. So that's our number two for the week.
I think that they do it, but people jump into new phones every year without any, with no hesitation. They're always getting the newest and the latest. I don't know.
Like I won't. If I meet somebody who has a flip phone, I won't even talk to them.
Right. Oh, yeah. You better hang up there, Kevin. He's, he's on his flip phone. Well, it just doesn't make sense because everybody's always, every time there's a new phone, it doesn't matter if they're using Samsung or iPhone, people are just jumping up all the time. I don't know that they need it to do that to get new phones, but whatever, you know.
I've got to admit it, it's kind of compelling because every time, okay, if it seems that every phone that I buy will last 2 years, then as soon as as soon as you're done paying for it, boom, it's done.
Yeah.
And it just happens to be the next model has come out.
Yeah, it could be, but I still think for the most part people want to get the new model. They can't wait for a new one and they just keep jumping out. And it never costs you anything, just a new contract.
I mean, if you think about it this way, like with cars, people want to go buy a car that's going to last a long time, right?
Yeah.
But with an iPhone, it's exactly what you say. It's like, I want it to last, and most people, they wouldn't even update every year. Unless they had to wait. They'd want the new one every 6 months. So no one goes buying a phone saying, hey, I hope this will last me a decade.
Yeah.
The way they do with a car. So.
Yeah, it's true.
And so our number one for the week gets a little bit weird, and that is that OJ is actually Khloe Kardashian's secret father.
Oh, wow.
So the conspiracy theory says neither Bruce Jenner nor her father, Kardashian, but actually OJ, who was, the father's attorney during the trial. Now, OJ has come out and denied this, and he said that's not the case, that he was never with their mother and couldn't be Khloe's father. But with that said, people are speculating, and this is quite a juicy one. No pun intended.
it's OJ's love child.
Yeah, and now he'll write a book about it. I'm not her father, but if I was, here's how I'd do it.
Ooh, there we go.
Now, what are they basing this on?
Well, there's always been some questions about her heritage in different tabloids, and this one just sort of popped up. I had never seen this before. But if you were to connect people, we know that the father was connected with OJ because he was his attorney during the trial, or one of the attorneys during the trial.
Yeah. Well,
it can't feel good if you're her and people are saying, hey, we think your dad is O.J. Simpson, and be like, hey, I think your dad is Charles Manson. It's not...
I don't know. That'd be a cool thing today.
I don't think she could feel anything anyway with all that filler.
Yeah.
So, and if we get hate mail for that, that's okay. That's okay. That I'll laugh at. Wow, that's something to think about now. I'm going to think about that all week.
Well, we are starting the year off strong, so I expect the next 51 weeks to have even better material for us. So.
Well, I like that. I'm glad that... I actually, it's good to hear one about OJ and kind of like, I don't know what kind of star to call her. She's not really a movie star or a singer.
Yeah, what have they done?
I'm just trying. That's why I was trying to call her something, and I didn't know what to call her.
Except just be crazy. Like, I mean, if I was Bruce, I'd come out a little.
Well, I'm in transition too.
If I deliver the Kardashians,
yeah, I'd switch too. Oh my! Well, that does it for the day. Well, thank you, Joe. That's always good to hear.
Well, thank you, guys. Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Happy New Year.